Hi, and welcome back to the Mindful Sport Performance Podcast. I'm Dr. Keith Kaufman.
And I'm Dr. Tim Pinot. And today we have with us Dr. Rezvan Amali. She's a clinical psychologist who's worked at a national leading research institute in several capacities since 2000, providing clinical services, teaching, and research collaborations. Dr. Amali has been studying, practicing, and teaching mindfulness for almost 20 years and is the author of the award-winning APA book, 25 Lessons in Mindfulness, Now Time for Healthy Living. She is a frequent lecturer on the subject of mindfulness to various government agencies, hospitals, and schools. She's also spearheaded the research and development of an abridged version of the well-known mindfulness-based stress reduction program, which is called mindfulness-based self-care. And she just published a randomized clinical trial looking at this intervention in the online journal JAMA Network Open. And on a personal note, Rezvan taught the very first formal mindfulness course that I ever attended over 10 years ago, and she has continued to be a valued teacher and inspiration to me ever since. We are extremely fortunate and very grateful that she's agreed to come speak with us today. Thank you so much for being here, Rezvan.
Thank you for having me. Before getting started, maybe we could do a quick meditation together.
That would be wonderful.
Thank you for joining me in this, and we will do it for like 3 to 5 minutes, and please join me in this short meditation. I'm going to announce the start and end of the meditation with the sound of a soft bell. Sitting upright if possible, back straight, chest open, shoulders relaxed and away from the ears. Sitting alert but also comfortable, allowing the breath to be easy and effortless. Gathering the attention from the outside and bringing it first to your immediate environment and then to the inside, and resting the attention on the flow of each in-breath and each out-breath. For the next couple minutes, we are going to use the breath as the anchor on which we rest the attention, and use the breath as the, again, anchor that keeps us in the present moment. Cultivating the awareness of each in-breath and each out-breath. The mind will invariably wander away, and there is nothing wrong with that. The job of the mind is to think and to wonder. And in this moment, we notice the mind has wandered away. we gently bring it back and refocus it on the flow of each in-breath and each out-breath. There is no right or wrong way to do this. We simply bring the attention and refocus it on the breath as many times as necessary. No need to change anything, simply observing what's already here. Thank you for joining me in this short meditation.
Well, thank you for leading us.
Yeah.
That was great.
Yeah. We were talking, you know, just before this about conditioning, you know, and like I mentioned in the intro, you know, Rezvan has been a mindfulness teacher of mine for a long time. And yeah, just listening to your voice, like that meditation, I just had all these images in my head of sitting in your basement. All those times. So I participated in a mindfulness group for a number of years that met at Rezvan's home. And it's just amazing how powerfully that stuff comes back up. Mm-hmm. Just the sound of your voice just really triggered all that.
That's true. That's why I always recommend people to have a place for their meditation that encourages the consistency of the practice.
Yeah. Yeah, those, right, those kind of external stimuli are so powerful at like getting us back to that, you mm-hmm. know, that presence of mind or that, you know, place we were in. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
One of my favorite parts of doing this podcast is just having different experiences with different guests and how they choose to lead the meditations. And I'm always curious to hear, you know, why someone chose the meditation that they did. You know, and I'm just curious what your thoughts are on that particular practice and, you know, why you selected it for today.
Oh, my understanding was for a short meditation. So I think for a short experience, breath is the most powerful vehicle for focusing attention. It's always available, and it's a very important and sensitive tool for focusing attention. So I think if there is only one thing you can do, is it should be mindfulness of the breath.
Yeah.
And actually, in my work with people who are severely ill, one thing that remains is the breath. A lot of other functions may be lost. And so, but you still can use the breath to help focus the attention, reduce anxiety, stress, and, you know, expectations, and, you know, various thoughts, and stay present in the body.
Yeah. And that's certainly, I mean, in our work, and, you know, in our MSBE program, we certainly have a kind of a strong focus on that, on breath. Both from the meditative perspective, right? Mm-hmm. But also, you know, helping teach, you know, athletes like the physiological implications of their breath. That, like, when we breathe in kind of anxious ways, we don't get oxygen into our bloodstream. We can't think as clearly, right? I mean, there are profound implications, right? When we breathe this way versus that way.
Right.
But it's a difficult balance for us. We talk about, you know, in terms of, you know, when you instruct someone, say, to breathe diaphragmatically, there's a right way and a wrong way, versus mm-hmm. when you're leading a meditation, right? You're letting go of those labels of right and wrong, and having people
right.
tune to whatever the breath feels like in this moment. So it's a kind of an interesting tension that we're always kind of balancing, and actually something that we were hoping to explore a bit with you, having so much experience in mindfulness, you know, curious to get your take on, you know, all of these different approaches now that people are creating, that are for specific purposes, right? Mindfulness for sleep, or mindfulness to reduce anxiety, certainly in our case, right? Mindfulness to enhance performance.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, like, I guess I'm curious to get your thoughts on that. Like, do you think that these, or what do you think of these types of interventions, or how do you deal with that tension between people who come to you, right, looking to get something specific from a mindfulness practice when the practice itself is about acceptance?
Right. Well, that is an inherent dilemma right there. The minute you expect something from the practice, you are working against yourself, because expectations increase anxiety, increase, you know, what they do is, like, all you can do is to not meet the expectation. And when you meet the expectation, it's like not a big deal. So there is nothing positive about that approach. So, I think relinquishing expectations is a big aspect of practice of mindfulness. And I think also in sports, I'm not expert in that field, I believe if people expect of themselves to, like, become, have a rank or an order or something, that would work against them. It would work against being in their body, being present in the moment. That kind of denotes a future orientation, which is not part of mindfulness. So again, that's the dilemma. But the reality is, when you cultivate acceptance and present moment orientation and beginner's mind, all those ingredients, and then you have to also develop trust, that with the trust in the process itself, that healing experiences will occur. And so I think in the realm of sports, I think whatever it is people are wanting from the mindfulness approach, then they have to at some point just trust the process and allow it to develop in its own timing. It's like, you know, when a butterfly kind of emerges from chrysalis, it's a natural process. Now, if we go to the chrysalis and try to help the butterfly and open it for the butterfly, the chances are it's not going to work. It's going to probably kill the butterfly. So I think all those elements that we talk about, the attitudes, the mindfulness, is present in this. It's like trust, allowing just things to develop in their own timing. And then at the same time, you put your best foot forward, you make your best effort without expecting X, Y, and Z. And then you trust the process. I think that probably is uniform across different uses of mindfulness. So,
yeah, I think that word trust is so significant, and I find myself using it a lot in terms of mindfulness and helping people to connect with and understand what we're really talking about here. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned a couple of times that word expectations, which is such a big part of what we teach in MSPE, and, mm-hmm. and that topic has come up some on our podcast before. But I think you mentioned it in a particular context, which is really important. And I don't know that it gets as much airtime as maybe as it should. When you said that, you know, with expectations, when people are chasing them, when you satisfy them, it's really just, okay, you know, I met the expectation. That, right. that you hear in sports a lot, people talk about the overemphasis on the negative, right? That if I succeed, that's what's supposed to happen. But if I fail, that's devastating.
Exactly. So expectations really do not offer a healing approach, let's say, a healthy approach, or a stress-reducing approach to the work of mindfulness. Yeah. So it's inherently, they do not mesh together.
So I know this is putting you on the spot a little bit, but I appreciate you humoring me for a moment, that because you said you don't work in sport and performance so much, and so you have a unique perspective on this. Why do you think that manifests so much, right? This attachment to this idea that that's how it has to be, this chasing of expectations, even though, as you said, it's not a very healthy system. Mm-hmm. And at some level, we know that, right? Athletes know that. They feel maybe that this is really stressful. This is uncomfortable. Something's mm-hmm. not right here. And yet, it's so hard to change it, right? The clinging continues.
Yes.
So what is your perspective on that? I'm curious if...
Well, because, you know, when we say do not expect, it's a new approach. It's a new learning. But the other learning has had a very long history, probably as long as we have been alive. Somehow or another, that message has been transmitted to us that you have to achieve. And I think in time, it loosens up. But again, you have to trust the process and realize that these old learnings do not leave us so immediately, that we have to be patient. And I think that's another attribute with mindfulness that we are developing at the same time, is the quality of patience. And so we have to patiently watch the butterfly to come out of the chrysalis. We cannot expedite it. We could provide the right conditions for it, which will help the process, but we cannot determine when that moment of opening occurs.
Yeah,
we just continually provide the right conditions, and you know, it's like tending the garden. It's like you put a seed, you give it good water and soil and da da da, but you cannot determine that exact moment of, you know, opening and development. You just have to watch it until it happens.
Yeah. Yeah. And it just, I mean, there's so many, what feels like really important things to what you just said, but I think the thing I feel really drawn to talk about is this idea of unlearning, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that is also like a kind of a new concept when someone comes to mindfulness. They're right. not just trying to learn a new set of skills. They actually need to unlearn
what they knew before. That's harder even.
Yeah.
That's harder. Because what happens is we kind of develop a certain automatic reactivity to things that you're not even aware of it. And with unlearning things, things have already become automatic, so we are unaware of it. And so in order to change something that has become automatic, we have to become aware of it first and then choose what is it that needs to be unlearned. Because we have also had a lot of good learnings. It doesn't mean that all conditioning is bad. That's not so. Some of it we want to keep because it helps us, you know, live our lives. What I noticed, especially during COVID, I can tell you a story of that. Once, right before we started working from home, I was at my workplace and I was in the elevator, and a young man came in with a Kleenex in one hand and stepped to the elevator and pushed a button with the other hand. And he was, you know, it was nice. And so I allowed myself to ask, I said, you know, I see you have a Kleenex in one hand and pushed a button with the other. What happened? He said, I brought the Kleenex with the specific purpose of pushing the button with it. And then the minute I came into the elevator, I forgot. So you see, with so that's one of my things that I say in my COVID talks is like the habit is so strong that for you to be able to change those habits, you have to first become aware, like to notice what it is you're doing, to notice what you're about to do. And so the moment-to-moment awareness is about all of these things. Or touching our faces, that's like really automatic. So that's one of the other thing that we had to shift and change during COVID, not to touch our noses or mouth or eyes or whatever. And for that, we had to become first aware of what we were doing so that we realized, oh, my hands are coming up. What am I going to do with it? You know, oh, I'm not going to touch. So you put it back down. So over time, you're able to break these habits, but it's not easy. And you see that with, again, with the COVID, we now are very motivated to do it. So we are more aware of our behavior, more aware of touching our faces or pushing the button of the elevator. But if COVID was not here, how many people would be motivated to really look at it, right? But now people are motivated, so they are willing to change that behavior. So the other part of it is, what's the purpose of me going through such a hard work?
Yeah.
To, you know, not touch my face. You know, before COVID, you couldn't convince many people that you shouldn't touch your face. So those are just examples of how breaking habits could be difficult. But nonetheless, mindfulness is the best way we know to make or break habits. And so, so in that sense, it's like the most powerful tool we have. Without awareness, there is no way to undo some of these things.
Yeah. And this issue of motivation certainly mm-hmm. comes up in our work a lot, right? Because this is new, this is different, and it is hard work, right? I mean, to really practice mindfulness, you have to practice, right? You have to give it time and attention mm-hmm. and dedication.
Exactly.
And right, so certainly a global pandemic can motivate someone, you yeah. know, but, you know, we
it's
find
life we're, and death sometimes.
Right. You know? But yeah, when we're working with a team or working with an athlete, sometimes it can be difficult to get them to tap into motivation, to undo some of this learning, to mm-hmm. unpack some of their automaticity and to do it differently. Now, I think in some ways that can be one of the advantages of someone coming to mindfulness for a specific reason, like I mm-hmm. want to perform better, or I want to mm-hmm. I want to reduce my anxiety, or I want to sleep better. Mm-hmm. Like that might motivate them and my hope is always that over the course of learning mindfulness, of allowing it to actually impact you, you begin to let go of some of those expectations. You see some of the impact that the expectations have and think about them differently. But I guess I kind of wanted to get your perspective as a very experienced mindfulness teacher, like, you know, short of having a global pandemic motivating people, like what do you do or say, or how do you get your students motivated to like give mindfulness the time and attention it needs?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't do anything. I, you know, I just am. Doing is not the purpose, really. And what I remind people is that mindfulness by its nature is a choice act. I mean, you choose into it. Mindfulness does not become automatic. It can become more and more a part of your life, but it never becomes automatic by its nature. It's always a conscious act. So, and in order to develop mindfulness, I believe there are four main components. The first component is intention. And so the intentionality cannot come from me. It has to come from the other, like, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's why I say you need to have a clear intention. Then you need, you will work on focused attention and then compassion. Those are like main ingredients. And the fourth main ingredient is the ability to observe, to witness your experience rather than becoming one with it. So observing of yourself, it's I think in the literature we hear the word metacognition, and that's what I'm referring to, is the ability to observe, and that gets strengthened by practice of mindfulness. And I also always tell people, whenever you feel you're faltering in your practice, just remind yourself of your original intention. That's why I encourage people to think about their intention almost on a daily basis as a part of sitting, let's say, for a practice or walking meditation or whatever it is they're choosing as their focus of practice. I think touching your intention on a regular basis is very, very important. It's just go back to your intention and don't forget that. So that doesn't come from me. It comes from the other. And I don't do anything. I just guide their experience. And I'm honored to have done that over time. But again, it's a conscious act, so it's not automatic, and that's why it's so powerful.
I wonder too, this feels like a segue in a way to talk about, it's kind of a really big deal that you had an article or have an article coming out in JAMA. Mm-hmm. And one of the big things, so is it already out right now, or did you forward us an advanced publication?
No, it is out.
So it's out right now. So definitely check it out. And I was really excited to read it. And one of the things that stood out to me is both in the design and then in sort of talking about the findings, one of the things you really hit on is the time commitment aspect. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I just wondered if you could speak about that, because now, I mean, it really is taking it into the science of how you implement mindfulness and how you research mindfulness. How you account for the kinds of things that you're talking about. And so if you'd be willing to talk about the study just a little bit, and maybe especially the aspects we're touching on right now, this whole idea of making a commitment to the practice.
Well, yeah, I always say making time is a very important aspect of developing a practice. Making place is a good thing. Like you have a place where you feel safe. Is safe and you can actually cultivate peace and calm. Although we also live in a very noisy world, so we have to learn to work with that as well and be able to stay mindful of anything that goes through the field of consciousness. It could be sound, it could be bodily sensations, and It could be thoughts or emotions, whatever it is that you you allow it to pass through your field of consciousness, and that's where the ability to witness experience becomes very important. And in terms of the time commitment, that's a very important issue, especially with professionals, healthcare professionals in particular. They're very stressed out. Patient outcomes typically are impacted by the quality of the state of the workers, basically. You know, we cannot, if they are distracted or tired or stressed out, the chances that errors increase goes up. So I think providing conditions of healing and mental health for healthcare workers is very important. And that's why I, you know, developed a program that was shorter and which was carried out during work hours so that the organization feels comfortable providing it. And so we saw that a shorter program could also be effective. And my personal view on developing a practice of mindfulness is any amount of practice is better than no practice. Again, in the field of sports, I'm sure there is a minimum practice that might be more so than, you know, other fields. But by and large, I think even a short practice on a daily basis is a very important thing to implement in your daily life, even if it is as short as a 1 minute pause a day. I think even that 1 minute a day is better than no minute a day. So I think for people who are new to this and they are just beginning to develop a practice, I think any amount of practice would be useful. And then when they start seeing the impact of that, then you know, it is hard to get into this state of mindfulness and say after 1 minute, okay, I'm done. Typically, in the beginning, you may feel that way, but then over time, you get encouraged to practice in longer durations. Or also, practice doesn't mean that you just sit on a cushion. If that's not the way you're operating in the world, you could do mindful walking or mindful eating on a regular basis. I mean, wherever you start, it's, you know, Buddha said there are 84,000 doors to Dharma. And so it's like each place you start, you need just the beginning. And I think a sacred pause and mindful pause, whereby you come to yourself, you just take a look at your body, take a look. I mean, take a look is not the right word. You just sense your body from within. You just sense where you are at. You sense your heartbeat. You sense where your mind is. It's just for 1 minute, you bring the attention from the outside to the inside and focus it on yourself. That self-awareness gives you clues as to how stressed you are or how relaxed you are. And just that awareness is in itself healing. And the more you do it, the more you realize that helps you, and therefore you get encouraged to do more of it. So I think one of the important things is to start to start where you're at and have a teacher or a program or whatever it is that meets you where you are at and help you move, take the next step, so to speak.
Yeah. And that's certainly something that's always been really important to us. Cause I view mindfulness similarly. It's like, it's the experience that guides you. You know, the more you practice, the more you will learn, and it will then kind of shape and promote your future practice, right? Mm-hmm. The challenge though is getting someone to have that initial taste.
Yes.
And so I, you know, when you were talking about your recent article and the design and how, you know, one of the things you did was to have the program during work hours.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to me like such a great example of like meeting someone where they're at, right? Because it's so hard for, and certainly it's been our experience too, like to get athletes to add something extra into their schedule. Mm-hmm. Everyone's like, but no, this isn't extra, right? We're doing this during practice. We're doing
this. Yes.
And really kind of right, creating the conditions mm-hmm. that would actually allow them to experience it. But I think it's been such a challenge for us. And perhaps you've experienced something similar, right? Because I think that the organizational influences are resistant, right? They have, certainly when it comes to sports, you know, there's this emphasis placed on physical training, right? And anything, any other form of training seems kind of like secondary or less than.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so to get coaches or athletic directors to buy in and say, no, we can actually take practice time to do mm-hmm. mental training. Because it's just as valuable as the physical training. I think it sends such a powerful message to the people like, mm-hmm. yep, we are putting these on an equal playing field. But I think there are, like I was saying, are forces that are resistant to that. And I guess I was curious if you've experienced that too with some of your research, or like getting people to do this during work hours. Like that can be a hard sell sometimes.
Right. Well, I think actually, like in the field of healthcare, what I think is the direct impact could be on patient care, like healthcare workers who are tired, who are stressed, who are not taking care of themselves. And I think they welcome the opportunity to do this during work hours. In other words, the organization indirectly is saying, yeah, we understand it is to our benefit too for you to be in your best mental state and physical state when you do your work. You know, it's a recognition of that. And I think, I know there is some research, I cannot cite it from the top of my head, but they have shown that when people are stressed out and the organization expect the workers to take care of themselves outside of work mm-hmm. hours, it creates resentment. Like I know like programs, I mean organization who offered something of that nature on a Saturday, let's say, during a weekend, I think people get resentful because they have to take already a stressed time schedule and take out of their family time or whatever to take care of their own stress. I think that could be, it can backfire, in other words. I think people do not want something added to their schedule. And that's why I think in the long run, it would be to organizations benefit to provide stress reducing or performance enhancing in your case during the allowed time, so that people don't feel this is an addition to their schedule. Now, practice outside of the class hours is something that hopefully the teacher encourages people and provides enough incentive, internal incentive, to people to do a little bit of practice mm-hmm. on their own. And I'm a big fan of incorporating mindfulness into what already exists. I say, like, when you go from one office to the other, from home to whatever place you're going, do that mindfully, because the speed of walk is not the element of mindfulness. You could walk in any speed, but just relinquish the future orientation about when am I going to get to the meeting? How fast should I? Those thoughts just prevent you from being in the moment. So, say I'm going from place A to place B, and then relinquish, and then do that act in a mindful manner, like go from place A to place B with a mindful attitude. It's an attitude. And so you don't have to add to your day. You could just do what you already do mindfully. One of the things I like to tell people is whatever cleaning ritual you have in the morning, if you take a shower or brush your teeth, whatever it is, do that mindfully. That's your start of the day with a mindful attitude. And I think my mindful shower is my own favorite. Like, you don't need to bring 100 people to the shower with you in your mind, right? You just you know, shower, just when you shower, just shower and have, and the richness of the experience with the soap and the smell and the warm water or cool water, or whatever, the richness of that experience could be helpful in bringing people to a mindful state, because there is so much coming in. And so I tell people, start the day with a mindful shower, a mindful toothbrushing, or
it's so great. It's so interesting. And again, I can't overstate that it's a big deal that this publication has happened. And, you know, in case it's not perfectly obvious, I know you're certainly speaking to it. You know, your work was with healthcare professionals, which is incredibly relevant to what we're dealing with right now with COVID and the pandemic and the amount of stress that's out there.
Right.
So as we start to bring this to a close, because unfortunately we are short on time, I wonder if you could just direct people to the publication and maybe just say the name of the study, or if there's ways that they can access it if they want to read it.
It's open access, so it's going to be easy to find. It's called Effect of a Brief Mindfulness-Based Program on Stress in Healthcare Professionals at a U.S. Biomedical Research Hospital.
Great.
And that's in JAMA Open, August of this year, 2020.
Oh, that's great. Thank you. And for any of our listeners who might be interested in your book or your work or reaching out, is there any way people can reach out or get more information about you?
I don't have a website, or, you know, like an active website. Mm-hmm. I had an old website. I have to think about how I may do this. The nature of my work is such right now that I'm just working in one place. So I think in my article, there is enough information that if people wanted to contact me, they could.
Great. And I'll just, I know I said it in the introduction too, but we'll repeat here. I mean, your book has so much, so many of the insights that you shared today. You cover it in many different ways. So, you know, I would certainly encourage people to take a look. It's 25 Lessons in Mindfulness Now, Time for Healthy Living. Because it just, even what you were just saying for me kind of circles back to that idea of unlearning, right? That we approach like taking a shower in the morning as a thing to do, to knock over our to-do list, and the idea that you have to unlearn that and approach it differently, that we can choose to approach anything we do from this mindful perspective is just so powerful, that our intention matters, not just what we accomplish externally, but our internal intention. I mean, it's so hard for people to like kind of shift and wrap their heads around, but it's just, I think it's so important for us to be talking about. So thank you.
It's all about our attitude and approach to what we already do. So.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. As Tim was saying, we just are so grateful for your time. You were certainly someone on our short list of people we wanted to interview when we started this podcast. And obviously you've meant a lot to our MSPE team and have been a great influence for us. So thank you for joining us, and thank you for all of your wonderful work. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
So for anyone out there who wants to connect with us, you're welcome to visit our MSPE website at www.mindfulsportperformance.org. You can also visit our MSPE Facebook page, as well as my Twitter feed, and I'm at Mindful Sport Doc, and Dr. Keith Kaufman is my name. And we are very excited with the launch of season 2 of our podcast that we've also got a YouTube channel that we've just started, which has the different exercises up that we have led and that our guests have led. So hopefully that can be a useful companion resource to our podcast. And if Rezvan's comfortable, hopefully we can include hers on that list and make that available.
I have asked permission. I will look into that.
Wonderful. So, well, we thank everyone for joining us today. And we also want to take one quick moment as well and thank our producer, Taylor Brown of EnduroMind and University of Texas at Austin, and our colleague, Dr. Carol Glass, for all of her support behind the scenes. So thank you for listening, and we will see you next time.
Yeah. Thanks, everybody.